Boom, we're on. And today's guest, we've got John Holmes. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
No problem at all.
Your brother Jack was convicted of the Essex Boy murders. He's just been released a few weeks ago.
That's right, yep.
How's things been?
Yeah, great. Jack's home now. He's home with me mum, which is always Jack's ambition, to be home with me mum, to look after me mum, you know. She's now just survived the COVID stuff, and she's 80-odd years old, and she's got a boy home, which has been the main objective all the way through. Yeah.
And that was 23 years?
24 years ago.
24 years he spent in prison.
Yeah.
Always go back to the start of my guest, John, just to get a better understanding of yourself, and we'll go right through everything. But we'll go back to where you grew up and how it all began.
Yep. Yeah, we grew up in the East End of London. Normal kids in a normal street, you know. Dad was a motor mechanic. We went to normal schools. Obviously, we was only 6, 7, 8 years old then, by the time. I think I was 9 when we left London. But, you know, the early days, we were just normal kids in a normal street.
How many's in your family at this time?
At that time, while we lived in London, there was 4 brothers and a sister.
Who's the oldest?
Terry, my oldest brother, Terry.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Who's the youngest?
Youngest one was my youngest brother, William.
So you and Jack are in the middle?
Yeah, me and Jack are in the middle, yeah.
What was you and Jack like as kids? Were you close brothers?
Yeah, we was close, and obviously always been close from day one, you know. And if I can tell you the incident of when we was kids in London, riding our little trike bikes, we went off up the street, as you do, and then, you know, my little trike broke down, allegedly, you know. You make it out as your kids, and Jack come along and towed me home, so, you know, saved me, really. And on my journey home, the coalman had delivered some coal, my trike hit the wheel, front wheel, I go over and lump of coal goes in my head and scars my head. And, you know,
bless me.
My brother Jack has come to my rescue. And obviously later on in life, I have to return that favour.
Yeah, and you've been trying to fight that favour for the last 20 years. How was your schooling, you and Jack? How many years are you apart, first of all?
1 year between me and Jack.
So they're twins, basically?
Yeah.
And he older?
Jack's older than me, 1 year older, yeah.
So the bigger brother, trying to protect his little brother all the time.
Yeah.
What was he like at school? Was he very protective then?
No, we all just got on with the school life, you know. We all went to normal schools, even when we moved up here to Suffolk. Just normal school life, no problems. We all left school 16, when you could then. All went into jobs because we would all work, you know. We wanted to go to work. None of us took any, you know, extra courses at school. We just wanted to go to work, which we did.
How was it working? What age?
Well, we originally, I started working about at 15 years old. I used to work for Artex Sealing Company, you know, before I actually left school and then actually went to work for them. Jack used to help me dad in the workshop because my dad was a motor mechanic, and Jack wanted to be a motor mechanic, and, you know, he learned from my dad, so Jack was probably early on.
He's ever in any trouble at school?
No trouble at school, no.
So good kids,
yeah,
no bother.
Yeah.
Good, raised by a good family, hard-working family.
Yeah, yeah, we never had problems at school.
When did you start getting into trouble then?
When we moved up to Suffolk, obviously then Londoners wasn't accepted that well up in Suffolk, so we used to get blamed for a lot of stuff. You know, a local parish magazine said Londoners moved to village because it was an unseen thing then. It was late 60s when we moved, that 69, I think it was. But we never got into trouble. We had, you know, the normal things when you had your moped, your motorbike and your first car. The local police used to stop you, but the old man made sure that all the indicators worked, your horn worked and all the things. So there's, you know, a few motoring offences they tried to get us on, but they never did get us on.
What was the first time you went to prison? Did you and your brother get the jail together?
Yeah, that was that. Me and my brother Jack, we went to jail for car ringing in the early 90s, 92 I think it was. We changed the identity on a couple of cars, and we got caught and decided, you know, we weren't going to talk to the police and all the courts and went to jail. First offence, first criminal offence, got 16 months.
For a first offence?
First offence. But then, you know, we chose not to... My dad brought us up, yeah. You know, my dad, East End of London, you don't talk to them people, say nothing, nothing will happen. And, you know, that was drummed into you and that's what we done. But wasn't the correct way to do it, as you learn later on in life.
When you were in that prison, that when you met Steele, Nichols and Tate?
Yeah, when we got...
Steele, who was Jack's co-accused?
Yeah, that's right, yeah, Michael
and
Steele, yeah.
Nichols was... The Supergrass.
Yeah.
And obviously Tate was the one who got murdered. So you were all in the same prison then, early 90s?
Yeah, me and Jack first went to Norwich and then we went on to Hosley Bay where we met Steele, Tate, Nichols, you know, all to do with the case. Nice enough guys, you know, everyone was in there doing their own sentences, really.
And who was it then? Did you become good friends, everyone?
Me and Pat got shipped out of Hosley Bay. Jack didn't know Pat because we was only in there two months and me and Pat got shipped out of there, out of Hosley Bay, and we went to High Point Prison. Jack stayed at Hosley Bay, Mick Steele was still at Hosley Bay and Nichols was still at Hosley Bay. So I'd been removed and Pat had been removed, So Jack obviously got to know Mick Steele, engineer, same thing as Jack, you know.
Same trade.
Nichols was in for currency fraud, I think, for printing money. And, you know, we all done our sentences and come out. I got shipped to High Point with Pat. And, you know, some weird, strange things went on there. But
what kind of stuff?
Well, Pat was like royalty in the jail, you know, because he's obviously been on a stretch before and he was 5 years into the one he was in when we got shipped there. And he actually, there was a thief within the prison, which you don't have in a prison, and the prison unit itself said, we've got to find the thief who's thieving from the cells. So they designated me and Pat to search everyone's cells while everyone stayed in the a room. So we went round and done that, me and Pat. Not the thing you want to be doing. Couldn't find nothing. And then a couple of days later, one of the young lads said, it's my mate who's doing the stealing. So someone grasped up on someone and it was a young guy who was always on the phone and everything, and he had stolen from the cells. When we come back from lunch one day, a couple of the guys had beat him up in the corridor outside me and Pat's room. And as we walked back from dinner, Pat's then come up the stairs and this guy lays there beaten by other inmates. So Pat said, what are you doing? What are you guys doing? And I said, well, he's a thief and blah, blah, blah. He said, no, Pat, well, no, that ain't how you do it. Think it's how you do it. So Pat comes into our room. I'm sitting on the bed like where you are, away from me. Picks up the red sauce bottle, which we had on our windowsill, which, you know, we had for our food, because we was in C category prison. Smashes it. Goes over and stabs a guy. Twists it in his face. This is a guy laying beaten, the thief. Pat picks him up, walks out to the landing, looks over the landing, drops him, hits the alarm bell, all the screws come out to the guy. The guy's, he didn't die, but he wasn't in a very well. So that's the way you do it, boys, Pat went. No, just drained out of me. You know, you think, shit, this is proper jail. You know, we was in a D category before, we're now in a C and I'm in with him.
Were you scared of him?
He was a very powerful man. He filled the doorways, 20 stone steroid up monster, but he was like a father to me in there, Pat was. You know, when he left, he paid his way out of the jail because he knew some of the SOs in the prison, and he paid some money up front and got shipped to another open prison within 2 months. But once Pat had gone, I was looked after like a lord. You know, I was being brought food late at night. there's some Turkish guys doing, you know, curry and keeping it warm on the radiator, and they turn up with it, and I just say to them, you know, I'll get you some tobacco or something, you know, for me private spends, because I never smoked or nothing. And they said, no, Pat. Pat said, you've got to be looked after while you was here. And I was. Lovely guy to me, Pat was, you know, smashing guy. He used to kick off with his wife like most people did, you know, but if she didn't come and visit or something like that, the normal things, but he was heavily into the drugs in the jail. And but he never served up out of our room, you know. I'm an anti-drug person anyway, and I was never going to go down that avenue, but he respected that, Pat did.
What sort of drugs was Pat taking inside?
Oh, he had everything from cannabis to heroin, LSD. You know, often I used to walk down the corridor and there'd be eight of them in the room, and they'd be injecting with a needle that, you know, when it pushed against your skin, it was a job for them to get it in, because eight or ten of them had used it or been used prior.
But ever on come downs or anything, especially when in prison?
I think the story of the come down, yeah, you're going to get that. But one of the things, when Pad left the jail, and an SO, I used to work out of the jail, so I was an outworker. And one of the SOs who Pat knew really well come across to me and said, are you getting on, John, all right? I said, yeah, fine. And I said, how did you know Pat? He said, oh, he's been here before. He said, but Pat makes our job easy. I said, well, I had to work that out then. So he says, he come here, filled the jail with drugs. He said, they'll all be calm. He said, our job's easy. They thought he was a smashing guy. They thought that was normal.
What did you do when you got out of prison?
When I come out of prison, went back to a normal job, same as Jack, you know, we'd done our time, come out, went back to normal jobs. I was a builder at the time, doing the building industry, and we just all carried on, you know. We never lost our jobs because we went to jail. You know, we just fitted straight back in where we was.
It was easy to get out of jail and go back into what? Did you ever think about going back into crime straight away?
No, I think then, you know, as the judge says, when he put us in the jail, you know, you need a short, sharp shock.
Shock treatment, yeah, back in the day.
Yeah, definitely.
Was that tough? I've had a few men on the show and they speak about that, how hard that was.
Yeah, it is hard in there. You know, you do see some horrific things and you see some young lads come in and, you know, they're fed drugs and they come out evil monsters out of them places, you know. It is hard, and even harder today, I should imagine, but it is a hard thing to do, to take over your liberties taken away.
And what was Jack's life like when he got out?
Yeah, he went back into his job. You know, his job was waiting the same. So he done his job and, you know, we carried on as normal. He was obviously friends with Mick Steele then, and, you know, because they had engineering. They're very similar people, really, in engineering. You know, they engineer stuff. And
Mick was older. He's over 20 years old, is that
correct?
Yeah,
Mick's older. Yeah, Mick's a lovely guy. Lovely guy. You know, I met him afterwards myself, you know, a couple of times, you know. And we'd have been out and had beer and, you know, barbecue and that. And
what's the helicopter incident?
Oh, the helicopter incident is that there was a couple of incidents. Is that was at the
Chelmsford.
Oh, at Chelmsford, yeah. When Jack and Mick obviously got arrested for the importation of drugs with Nichols, obviously they was then taken to police station, and then they was taken to Chelmsford to be remanded in a proper prison. So on the way there, they was in these armoured vehicles, three or four armoured vehicles in front, three or four armoured vehicles behind, going through Chelmsford. As they was going through Chelmsford, the crew on the ground, the police on the ground, hadn't told the chopper of where the convoy was going. So it turned off its track. The helicopter landed instantly in the park at Chelmsford, just come straight to the ground, and all these armed men jumped out the helicopter because they wanted to know why this has happened. You know, and you'd never seen anything like it. And I was at the magistrate court that day thinking, whatever's going on here, you know, you've got armed officers laying in the road, you know, with armed safety catches on, but incredible. And then they bring Jack and Mick along, you know, with all these armoured vehicles.
How long did that trial last? Was it 6 months?
Well, that was the magistrate's court one. That was so they was remanded in custody. That was only a day, that one was. But then on that incident there, you know, all the families was there. Well, not all of my family, but I was there. You know, Steele's family was there and all the rest of it. And then you know that they got charged with the murders as well at the magistrates' court at Chelmsford.
They weren't just charged with
importation, they were charged with the murder.
With Tony Tucker, Pat Tate and Craig.
Yeah.
What's his second name? Rolf?
Craig Rolf, Rolf. Yeah.
Is that when Nichols turned Supergrass?
Yeah, well, Nick, what actually happened with Nichols, Nichols got caught going back into Braintree, where he lived. He was driving along with a friend of his behind in a car. They had 10 kilos of cannabis with him. They got stopped by Essex Police unit. And when they got stopped on the side of the road, they said to Nichols, "What you got in your car?" Search his car. Nothing in his car, but the guy behind, I think his name was Colin Bridge. I'm sure it is now. Yeah, it is Colin. He had 10 kilos in the van. So Nichols gets out and says, "Look, I'm with you guys. I'm working with you guys." Nichols was actually working with the Essex Police. But the officers that stopped him said, "Sorry, we're South East Regional Crime Squad. We're watching you and the police." So Nichols thought he was bulletproof because he was working with two police officers. He was selling drugs, Nichols, telling the police where he was selling the drugs. The police was going nicking him, getting the money, getting the drugs, giving the drugs back to Nichols, keeping the money to the officers. Nichols sold the drugs. Lovely little circle.
Round and round it goes.
And then obviously an outside force like the South East Regional Crime Squad look at that and think, hang on, we'll watch these officers. And that's what they found. And then, of course, once Nichols then gets in custody and the two police officers in mind, they're in custody as well. They get taken into custody. Nichols has got to get himself out.
So he starts singing like a canary.
Yeah.
So when your brother Jack and Mick are in, what were they expecting for the drugs charges?
They
a few years, five.
Yeah,
to 10.
They would have got a few years for it. Like anyone would have done. But we knew from the beginning what Nichols was coming out with wasn't true.
So when did he? What was it like then for your brother when? Was it a chap at the cell to get the other charge of three murders? Was it because he was still in prison to say, look, you're being charged with these three murders?
That was done at that magistrate's court, you know.
So they'd done it at the court? Yeah. What was going through Jack's mind then?
Everything, because obviously they brought Nichols there as well, you know, to go against his fellow mates, you know. But Nichols had no choice. He'd been dealing with police officers. It was a mess, you know. You got police officers being arrested, Jack, Mick, Nichols, others being arrested. It was just a mess. So something had to give. And obviously they'd had Nichols for 6 or 7 days. Nichols made 28 statements in that time before he got a statement, mm-hmm. what he thought was right.
So the murders happen. They get charged with drugs. They're in remand. And then they get charged for the murders while in prison.
When they was getting remanded, mm-hmm. for the drugs, they then put the murders on them that day in Chelmsford. So they was charged. I was there when they done it.
And what was Nichols? What did he end up getting out
of? He then become a Supergrass, so he could get a new identity. Mm-hmm. Him and his family got moved instantly. He had the choice to do that.
How long was the murders after it done for when they get charged?
6 months. I think the murders happened in December.
Yeah, December 1995.
Yeah, and Jack and Mick was charged in May.
And they had nothing to do with it?
No, there was nothing. There was
so
no...
what evidence did they have when they went to court? Because I know there was Nichols. Just Nichols, because there was no DNA, no forensics.
The trouble with it, and I preached on about it for years, because one of them cases you got no DNA. There was no guns. There was nothing. No motive, which is the main thing. No motive. There was nothing in this case. The only thing they had was Nichols. And then, obviously, Nichols, we had an Old Bailey trial of 6 months. So Nichols had to come and give evidence in there for 2 weeks, given his evidence, in which he got tore to bits in there by a legal team.
So what evidence stuck for them to get Layford?
Through the six-month trial, the trial lasted for 6 months, and the judge summed up for, I think it was about 16 days, the judge summed up. There was telephone evidence for mobile telephone evidence, it's the early days of mobile telephones, that backed up some of Nichols' story, you know, but we knew that the evidence was doctored, been played around with. So we knew what we was up against. So we knew we'd walk that trial. We knew it because we could rip it to bits. And the legal team we had, which was fantastic, you know, we knew that. But it didn't go that way. And after the six-month trial, the judge turns around to the jury, and he's, because his judge's final words of his 16 days summed up, he says, "Heed my advice. If you believe this guy, Nichols, convict. If you don't believe him, acquit." So that was the only evidence. After 16 days of summing up, you could tell with the judge that he's thinking, this guy's a liar or he ain't. So he's telling the jury to do that. He's telling the jury to do that.
So one man's evidence is enough to convict?
Yeah.
So even though he was caught with them for drugs, he'd been in prison with them before, he stood there, became a supergrass, started pointing the fingers, and that was enough to put two men behind bars for life?
For life, yep.
What was Jack thinking when he got found guilty?
Poor, devastated, obviously, like the rest of the family. Devastated. But on the way through the trial, there was an incident in a trial. Jack was about to give his evidence in the box at the Old Bailey. Obviously, from our previous journey to jail, we realised it don't pay not to talk. So Jack takes the box in the Old Bailey. So we're sitting in the Old Bailey. You've got a protected jury underneath. No one sees him jury, only Jack, Mick, Nichols and the court. So that's protected. Jack goes to take the stand in the box. As he goes to stand in the box, there was eight armed police comes in the public gallery, where we're sitting in the public gallery. I wasn't there that day. And they arrest my mother, who was then 60-odd years old, and my younger brother, and take him off to Snow Hill Police Station, just as Jack was going to give his evidence. So there's obviously a big commotion in the court. The next day, our legals asked, what is this reason? Because they've still been held. And they said that me mum, who was 60-odd years old, tried to get to the jury on St Paul's train station. Now, bearing in mind, we're sitting in the public gallery, or they was it that day. We can't see the jury. The jury don't know who Mrs. Womes is or her other son, or did they? We don't know this, you see? So they've arrested them, and they said that they was trying to get to them on a tube station. Well, the following day, I went to get the CCTV from British Transport Police from St Paul's. It's already gone. We never got access to that. We wasn't given that. There was no attempt. That was to rock Jack in the box, you see, but Jack still give his evidence in the box. And my mum was then banned, this was halfway through the trial, of a 2-mile exclusion zone, my mum and my younger brother, from going to the Old Bailey.
Where was Jack when the murders happened?
When the murders happened?
Yeah.
Jack was in a, he was about a mile away from the scene. I don't know whether that's the time of the murders, because there's conflicting times, you know, there's the time of the murder, they say, was 7 o'clock, but there's obviously other things that point to later and early hours of the morning. And
did they not have an alibi or anything?
Jack had an alibi, yeah.
Other witnesses to say he was with them?
Yeah, Nichols asked him on the morning of the 6th of December, Nichols' car had broken down in the vicinity of Retterton, and said to Jack, will you go and pick my car up? My car's broke down. So Jack said, I can't do it now, Darren. I'll do it later on. So Jack goes later on, takes a trailer and a thing, and goes and picks up. And it was in a pub car park. Jack gets there, picks the car up, rings Darren up. So I've got your car, Darren. It's on the back. I'll take it back to my yard. Darren said, just get rid of it. Get rid of it, Jack. He said, it's fucked. It's broke. You know, so Jack takes it back to the yard and it would just run out of transmission oil. It was automatic, so it wouldn't drive. Jack puts an oil in it. He was going to take it and scrap it, but he didn't. So he just sold it to one of the travellers that come in. One of the guys come in and said, yeah, take it away.
How connected to Tate, Tucker and Rolf was Nichols? Was there any connection?
Nichols to Pat, yeah. Nichols kept in contact
because
with
of the
Pat.
Prison days?
Yeah, because the prison days and the drug dealing. Mm. You know, obviously Nichols was drug dealing and there was a connection to Pat.
So when Jack get found guilty, all the evidence, no evidence against him, what do you think? Was it mass police corruption or or just a, one of those ones that was a miscarriage of justice? They actually thought it was him, or is it a just blatant setup?
I used to, because once Jack got weighed off at the trial, obviously they got 3 life sentences to do a minimum 15 years. And when you listen to that, 3 life sentences, do a minimum 15 years.
Yeah, that's lenient.
It's lenient. You got it. It's lenient. So why did the judge do that?
Because he knew that.
He knew that judge. Yeah, he knew that judge. Why would he do that?
So why did they end up serving 24?
What happened? Because they got 15 years, that was when their first date of parole, they would have been allowed to go for parole. Jack Straw, at the time, the Home Secretary, changed all lifers to life. So Jack, Mick and all other lifers go to 25 years. Someone within the jail system, another inmate, challenged it in the European Court of Law, won it. So the Home Secretary at the time had to re-tariff everyone back. So they put Jack and Mick at 25 years. Mick then got 3 years off because of he appealed against it. Jack didn't bother because they're going to be sitting there for 20-odd years and just didn't.
Did ever offer him a deal to admit it and get let out earlier?
Yeah, so Mick Steele's tariff become lower. Jack stayed at where it was, and later on in the sentence, Jack got his reduced.
By 2 years?
Yeah, by 2 years, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what was going through your mind, Mick's family's mind, your family's mind when that happened? Did you think it was just a bad dream?
Yeah, when you woke up, this is strange, when you woke up with a night, you know, Jack's been weighed off, life sentence, and, you know, you're on every radio station, every TV program, every newspaper, daily. And you wake up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet and you think, what's Jack doing now? You know? You can get up and go to the toilet, you can get up and do this, make yourself a cup of tea or whatever. You know, that's what used to go through my head. You know, this is wrong. And we could see, and I could see what they'd done. You know, don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-establishment, but there's good and bad coppers. There's quite a few bad ones in this crew, you know.
Did you feel as if they had a lot of pressure on them, the police, to get a conviction?
Yes, 100%.
Because I had Joe Steele and TC Campbell on my show 2 years ago, 2 men who served over 20 years in prison for the ice cream wars in Glasgow. Police corruption again.
Mm.
Listen, there's good and bad cops, it's like anything you do in life, but they got their conviction overturned after 20 years, no evidence.
Yeah.
People don't realise that this stuff happens. It happens a lot more frequently than people think.
It does, yeah.
So when you were, because you've always fought for your brother's freedom, you've always done protests. What sort of protests were you doing?
Once Jack got weighed off and I took it on myself, well, I ain't having this. I'm not having this, you know. I'm gonna protest. I'm going to highlight this case and I'll keep this case highlighted. And I took it on board. I didn't see anything else. That was my direction in life. Me work, me family, me home, me own family at the time, you know, they all got pushed aside. That was my focus. I'm going to highlight it. I'm going to make this a high-profile case. It was already high-profile. I'll make it even bigger, you know. I'll take this to the rafters. So straight away, instantly, when those 2 police officers, after about 6 years, come up for an internal inquiry, I thought, no, I ain't having that. Why should them cunts have that? an internal inquiry. So I thought, no, I'll stop that. So I planned the gantry, the M25. So I climbs the gantry just before the Dartford Bridge, gets up there, and I put on one side Jack Wombs, Michael Steele, innocent of the Rettledon Range Rover murders. On the other side, the main side, when you see the traffic coming towards you, the side of the road I was on, corrupt police hearing behind closed doors. So I gets up in that gantry at 7 o'clock in the morning, climbs up there. When I get up there, 7:30, the sun on the next bridge taking photographs. That was organised by someone else. So by the end of that day, I was on every radio station, I was in every newspaper the next day, and I was on every TV programme that night. And I stayed up there for 8 hours. And I had police down there. All the stunts in the world was pulled on me up there while I was up there.
Like what?
There was a car that sat about a mile away, and it sat there on the side of the road, and the guy would get out, a police officer, you see, because the first thing, a copper pulls up, normal copper, and he says, can I have your number? Can I have your number? So I said, no, because you'll cut my phone off. So he said, John, just give it, we'll have communication, because they couldn't come up, because I'd roped all the ladder off, so they couldn't get up there. So I'm up there. They've stopped the M25 at this stage, completely shut it because of this incident. So this guy's going, give me your number, John, give me your number. So I said, no. And I thought, no, I'll have the communication. So I'll give him your number. At the time, my number ended in 222. I'll give him 333 on the end of my normal number. So within 10 minutes, my phone rings. So I said, we better stop fucking lying now, haven't we? Because I've just given you the wrong number. So you already have my number. Okay, John. He's going. So he said, what's your aim? I said, I'm going to sit up here. I've got my lunch. And if I've stayed all night, I want our solicitor, Chris Bowen, in that hearing at Chelmsford Police HQ to see these two officers that was drug dealing with Nichols. There's disciplinary hearing. Our solicitor should be there. I want Jack Straw to know that I'm up here. That's my request. Then I'll come down. And they said, give us some time, John. With that, they've come back about a half hour later. And they said, John, Jack Straw knows, which it would have done. I was on every radio station, like I say, TV. There were masses of TV people there. And he said, but your solicitor can't go into that hearing. So I said, well, don't fucking come down then. So he says that, you know. So I stayed up there for 8 hours. And then there was this guy in the distance, what I was going to tell you about, in a car, sat long way up. And this is the guy communicating with me on the phone. So he gets out of the car and he's talking away to me. I'm walking about on the gantry talking to this copper. He's a trained negotiator. So he's talking to me in the car, standing out of the car, walking around the car. Talking to me, I can just about see him in distance. So I'm talking away to him on my phone, like this. And as I'm talking to him, because he's trying to get me down, you see. So I click him off. I cut him off, you see. I've still got my phone to me here, so has he. He ain't took his phone away and thinking, oh, I'll dial him again. So it was a guy in the car who was a negotiator. This guy was a dummy. And I'm thinking, why is this? Then there was a van sit there. It said red alert on the side. A transit van, all blacked out windows, red van, phone box red. Sat there the whole time. I think, where are they? So anyway, so I sit there the 8 hours. I'm up there. And then this guy who was in the car, who I've worked out now, rings me up and says, John, you are on every radio station. You're on every TV programme. Jack Straw knows this. You're massive all over the media. He said, the tailback is back to the A12, over 8 miles, 8 or 9 miles. He said, there hasn't been any incidents. He said, there's been no bumper to bumper. There's been no one hurt so far, John, today. He said, I'm asking you to come down before someone gets hurt. He fucked me.
Yeah, that's a fair point, isn't it?
Fuck me. So come and get me. So then they had to send a special unit up and the rest of it. But when they come up on the gantry, and I was on the gantry, my feet was chained, one of my feet was chained to 2 4-15 power cables up there. And they went, "Where's the key, John, to that?" I said, "In Suffolk." So they had to go away, get bolt croppers, and they took them chains off of me without touching me. Explained to me how to get down the ladder. I'm a builder at the time, I know how to get down. But all health and safety dealt with properly. In the car, get in here, put the seatbelt on me. Never even touched me, put it in. Boom. Nice gun up the M25 the wrong way, you know, because it was shut. Off to Grace Police Station, bang me up.
Yeah, but would have done that if there wasn't press and that, and there people seen that.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah,
they'd have kicked fuck out you if no one was there.
And the woman sergeant in the car, going back, and they was talking about, you know, I was saying about police, and they said, "Well, it's good and it's bad, John, yeah," and the rest of it, going on in the car. Got me back to the station and then searched me. I had a big yellow coat on with Jack and Mick and all the rest of it on there. Searched me.
So you came through the trial, John. There was a guy called Billy Fisher. There's a guy called Billy Jasper.
Yeah.
Billy Jasper gave evidence to say that he was paid.
That's right.
But there was a phone call as well to the person who had done the murder, but it wasn't used as evidence. Why is that?
Billy Jasper and Gal was called to the Old Bailey to give evidence. They both called there because they'd obviously admitted, I think it was in January after the murders, that they'd done it for someone in the East End or something, and they said the route they went into the lane, and they was paid $5,000, I think it was at the time. But when they was got into the box, because obviously they was both in prison at the time, they was warned that they could end up with a murder charge on them. So basically the police had got to them and they was retracted out of there.
But if somebody's admitted it, then why is it not being used as evidence?
They wanted Jack and Mick for it.
Why did they want those two so bad for it?
Because they caught Nichols with drugs, dealing with police officers.
Corruption.
You had to cover it up. Mm-hmm. It took the number for that, you see. It took the numbness off of that. Them two police officers are obviously 6 years on full pay at home while this is all going on.
Is that the main reason why you think they've been convicted for it?
I think that they had to get Nichols to do 28 statements. They had to get Nichols right. And, you know, we could hear what they'd done with him. You could hear it on his tapes, what they'd done with him. You know, to get that right. And they went in with that chance at the Bailey.
When they got the lifer, did you ever think they would get an appeal easily, that they would be out in a few years because there's nothing against them? Did you realise it would go as far as it did?
I knew straight away. I thought, well, we're going to go for an appeal and we're going to get this because we're going to tear this to shreds, you know. But you don't realise how corrupt and how big the case was. And of course, the fact then, you know, I started protesting, I'm making it higher profile.
What did you do with the body? A body in a trolley?
Yeah, I went after the gantry. I'd done the Crown Prosecution Service. No, this was after the gantry, I'd done the Home Office. I took a fake body on a trolley, you know, a hospital trolley. Pushed it down the road, covered up, you know, it's just a dummy. I was going to go in the Home Office in London with it as a publicity stunt to create more about the case for no time of death, because obviously Tate, Tuck and Rolf was never given the time of death. They decided, they knew how they died, there's no point in doing the time of death.
Why is that?
Because it'll give a different time.
Mm-hmm. To who was there at the area?
They would have come up with a different time, you know.
See, the forensics, if it was two people who'd done the shootings, would it not have been shot at different heights as well? If you know what I mean, like the forensics, if somebody got shot in the head and Some people say it was two people that done it, some people say it was one. If it was one, then they would have been shot at a different level, the same level, but if it was two, it would have been different levels. The forensics not do any of that stuff?
If you see the murder photographs, which, you know, I've seen, it's so professional and so clean. You know, there's not a lot of mess in that motor. You know, you see photographs, you know, when the bodies are out, there's obviously a lot of blood in there then, but when they're sitting in situ, it's just precision. You know, that's a proper marksman. That's a military style, that mm-hmm. is.
How was Mick going through his trial? Because he was a bit older.
Was
there people fighting his corner as well, family members, friends, trying to get a retrial?
Yeah, I think obviously Jack and Mick then went into overtime and, you know, sat and went through their case and scrutinised it and, you know, was coming up with all the things that they'd done to us, which had done so much to us.
How hard has it been as well with all the films and all the books being out, bringing it back? Because it's like it's never ending. It's like there's more eyes on it now, more people talking about it now than there was 25 years ago. How hard was that for the family to see it all plastered over online?
To begin with, my ambition was to keep it highlighted. So when the books started to come out in the films, I used to say to the people that are doing it, do it properly. You know, let's do it properly. Don't fake it or nothing like that, but you get a producer or something and he's going to do it his way and that's the way he's going to do it. You know, it's like any interview you do on the telly, the news or anything else, they're doing it their way, not your way. And that's what I had to learn. I had to learn, one, to be interviewed, and two, to learn to talk to them people. To begin with, I used to say, police, 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 police done this, police done that, police done that. I never got on the telly. Then I changed it. The authority's done this, the authority's done that, the authority's done that. I took the word police out, boom, I'm on the telly. Ah, now I'm learning. I'm on my way.
How hard has it been for you? There was a lot of tears, John.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
And did Mick or Jack ever feel that ending a life in prison?
They always knew that they'll come out on an appeal, you know. Mm. There was so much wrong with it. It was so much wrong. I don't know, you know, you never hear from Jack and Mick how they dealt with it within themselves, in their own minds in the prison, but I know from my family what it done to my family, you know. We was a close, very close-knit family, and, you know, it just ripped it apart.
Did any of your family ever involved in crimes like that before?
No.
Murder, just all robberies?
The only ones is me and Jack with a bit of car ringing. Mm-hmm. You know?
So there was no previous Jack shooting people before? No. Nothing like that?
No.
I had Steve...
If there would have been, Essex Police would have found it. Yeah. Wouldn't they? Yeah. Essex Police spent months and months and months up in Suffolk interviewing people that we knew, Jack knew, I knew, trying to find out shit on the family. Mm-hmm. But there was no shit. We were just a normal family.
Do you know who done the Essex Boys murders?
Do I know who done it?
Yeah.
I would say it's got to be police or military style.
Because I had Steve Ellis on, who says it was his dad.
Yeah. This one's now come to light. Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I was a bit angry about Nipper to begin with, because I've known Nipper a lot of years. Lovely, lovely guy. Took me 7 years to find him, mind, after Jack's case, because I knew that he was one that, you know, allegedly meant to have shot Pat and he was heavily involved. I needed to find him. Met him, lovely guy. And we've been in contact on and off over the years, and then of late to come out with what his dad told him, I was a bit angry, but then... If my dad told me the same, you know, I've lost my dad the same as Nipper, you know.
Same.
Yeah, Jack's lost his dad while he was in prison.
Yeah, same, leukemia my dad went.
Yeah, so, I respect, you know, I messaged him straight away and I said, Nipper, why don't you tell me? He said, John, my dad, I understand it. People say to me now, John, Nipper's come out of his dad, what do you reckon? Nipper's talked about his dad doing it. His evidence has not changed from 20 years ago when he was the second person arrested. Nipper's. Nipper's talking to people, like it's spoken to you, hasn't changed. So he hasn't got a copy of his statement. If he can remember that up here, that guy's not lying. I believe there's a lot in what's coming out there.
And how does that make you feel that your brother's and his friends in prison for life for somebody else's murder?
Still throws me anger towards the establishment, you know. We're 25 years on now. You know, my anger is the establishment. It's not me. It's, you know, the truth is going to come out. You know, you've got officers turning around there, Essex police officers. You've got the original officer that arrested Nichols turning round. You know, and there's more, so I've heard.
What about
whistleblowers?
Anger towards Nipper or his dad?
No, I've got no, you know.
If it was true.
He's dealt with it his way, and I'm too old now. In the earlier days, I would have done another protest or something, you know, but Jack's home now, he's with his mum.
Yeah, because a lot of people will question it. Why now say that statement? Is it because Jack's out now? Is it because maybe they're trying to get money for it, which is rightly so, but why make the statement now and not 5 years ago, 10 years ago? So it can be a difficult one for people looking from the outside.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. I can see that people thinking, you know, is he bullshitting or is he not? Yeah. I don't think it's bullshit. There's too much in his...
Too much pain in his eyes.
Yeah, you can't pick at the bits what he's saying. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm especially picked this case inside out to bits over the years. Mm-hmm. And you can't pick what he's saying to bits.
So why can't they use that in court?
Again? Why wouldn't they, though? Why would they? If they take that back to court, they're straight away admitting Jack and Mick.
They're innocent.
Yeah. They ain't going to go near this story, you know. This story is going to be dissolved in an appeal court, you know. It's with the CCRC at the minute. That'll get referred back. That will be resolved in a court of law. Jack and Mick's name will be cleared.
What about the Sun newspaper you were in? You done an article 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Just came through some stuff. I think a lot of investigators come through
and
done the case and basically says, look, those guys never done those murders.
Yeah, there's three police officers to do with the case. That, you know, I think they're called TMI or something like that. They've got videos online. Similar question to what you asked me. Why now? Why have they come? This is an officer that arrests Nichols and other officers to do with the case. Why come now? Why not come? You know, I'm not saying all police are bad. I have a police officer who rings me every year. He lives in Spain. How's Jack? Lovely, lovely guy. Used to come water skiing with us, everything. Lovely man. He was our local sergeant where we lived up in Suffolk. So there's good and there's bad. And you've got to ask yourself, these guys now that come forward, yes, they're helping the legal teams, blah, 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 but why now?
Do you think you'll ever get closure on it for Jack, yeah. Mick, yourself?
The closure will come.
How hard have you been fighting over the last few years? Does it get tiresome?
I think really going back to one of my last stunts at the High Court, we had an appeal in 2006. And when we had this appeal, the Daily Mail newspaper at the time took us on board, got my whole family to keep them to themselves, took us to the hotel. We sat in this appeal hearing. And then at this appeal hearing, we had so many points because the supergrass in the case, Nichols, had written a book. And we found out in the book he'd been paid money. And we had this appeal and we proved it in the appeal court. So we knew we'd won. But the judge deferred the judgment for a month.
Why is that?
Because he needed to sit back. Three judges in the appeal court. Sit back, diagnose it and come up with what they're going to do. Or obviously be told what they're going to do. Was what I used to think at the time. And they obviously deferred it for a month, come to the day of the appeal. You know, you're going back to the highest court in the land, family all taken there, but the Daily Mail looked after, perfectly. And we were in a hotel the night before. So we're sitting in this hotel, sitting in a bar. I goes up to the room to go to the toilet, because you don't normally like using the hotel toilets if you've got your own room, do you? So you go, you think there's your sentry. So you go, I go up to my room, my phone's on the side and it's ringing. So I picks the phone up. It's a woman from a reporter from the Daily Mirror. She says, John, I want your first opinion on where Jack's lost the appeal tomorrow. I think, who is this woman? Who is this woman? You know? And I know someone very high up in the Daily Mirror. And I thought, I'll ring him because he's been a godsend all while I've been protesting. And his ears at the top of the mirror. So I rings him up and I says, his phone goes through to a broad tone. So I know he's abroad. Rings him up. He says, John, I'm on this. I said, yeah, just one thing. I said, one of your silly girls just rung me up and asked me about the appeal tomorrow. Give me 10 minutes. He rings me back. He's in Tenerife. Rings me back. He says, John, that's right. You've lost your appeal tomorrow. I'm thinking, are they right or are they not? Can they be right? So I thought the next morning, I've got to tell my mother. So it goes, next morning we're going to court to tell my mother. She's going, no. I tell the legal team, no. Tell the barristers, the QCs, everything we've got there. No. We won it. We could tell we'd won it. Then you see the Essex police come in the court for the answers. They're full uniform now with their superintendent and all his full uniform. All got smiles from here to here on their face. Judge comes out. Yes, there was a problem here with Nichols, blah, blah, with officers, but not these officers. The appeal's gone. How did that fucking girl know? How did that girl know? 2011, that was 2006. In 2011, the phone hacking come out. Them judges must have been hacked. It's the only way. Three High Court judges was never going to tell City Daily Mirror reporter.
Mm-hmm. So they had the information?
They had the information. They was right.
Mm-hmm.
But it haunted me. It haunted me bad.
Yeah. Because your paranoia can play a massive part in all this as well. And then before you know it, destroys your mental health. And
yeah,
it's hard, especially if you know your brother's innocent and that's all you're fighting for. Would Jack do a polygraph test?
Yeah. 100% he would, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were they treated in prison with the three murders, Jack and Mick?
Yeah, fine. You know, they went through a sentence, you know. Obviously, they had their problems within the jail, you know, which happens in every jail. There was a problem with, you know, they was making bacon sandwiches and you can't have bacon in the jail now. You know, that's been banned because the Muslims don't like it. So there's a problem there and there's obviously a few fights and Jack and Mick both got injured badly. Just the normal things, you know, what happens within a jail.
How's Jack? He's coming out to COVID and the lockdown. It's not as if much has really changed then. It's he can't get out. How was his very first day out after spending over 20 years in prison?
He went straight to my mum's and, you know, he'd been working out of a prison anyway, so...
Yeah, home leaves.
Yeah, he's had home leave, so he was just... Jack will carry on fighting his case now. My job's done. Jack will carry on fighting now with his legal team, you know, so he's at home, he can sit there in his own comfort and go through it all at his own pace and not have the pressures of, you know, having your light turned off or you can't do this or you can't do that.
How do you think he'll adapt now that he's out for good?
He'll adapt to cocaine, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. He's strong, you see, because...
He's still young as well. He's only in his 50s. Like Mick's in his 70s, it's a different ball game as well.
Yeah, Jack's now 60. So, yeah, he's still relatively young, I suppose, same as me, sort of thing, but he'll just get on. That's what we do.
Yeah, just got to push on. So where do you go from here, John?
What's the steps? It'll go back. Obviously, the Criminal Case Review Commission's got it. They've got it, and that'll be referred back to the Court of Appeal, and that one, I reckon, will win.
And what happens there then? Because this will be one of the biggest miscarriages of justice ever in the UK's ever seen. That this goes deep then. Do they want this to get thrown out or change the conviction? Because the shit then that will be questioned will be unbelievable.
I reckon probably what they'll do at the end, they'll probably let it get overturned with a technicality of something we've come up with, or the lawyers, not we, the lawyers have come up with. And I reckon that will get, that will definitely get overturned, but what they'll say then is, the question will be asked, are the Essex Force looking for anyone else? And the answer will be, due to the passage of time, we're not looking for nobody else. In other words, we think Jack and Mick are still guilty. They ain't got to answer the question, have they? Mm-hmm. They do it with all the cases.
Has any of the police ever came forward and says to you, look, we don't think it's them, after the case, after the conviction?
Only the ones that are coming out of the woodwork now.
They came forward before?
No, not before, no.
Oh, just the ones that are speaking out
now? The ones
that
are speaking out now.
Why now that they're getting, that he's out?
I don't understand it. Is it a money thing? Is it a to make yourself look big, or is it the truth? Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to ask.
Did you ever question Jack over it? Did you ever think to yourself that he'd done it?
I would know. We'd done everything together. I would know. If Jack went there to a scene like that, is he going to take a bunch of mates? You know?
What was it Nichols says to get them? What was it he says that he'd picked them up? He'd picked them up, dropped them off, and then they went and killed the three of them?
Yeah.
Mick and Jack?
That's what he said. He dropped them off. They'd done the dirty deed, and then he picked them up.
What was Mick's alibi?
Mick was, I think, I forget where he was. Mick lives in Essex anyway, so he was somewhere in Essex. Mm-hmm. I forget where his alibi was, Mick's. But it didn't, none of it, they tried to link it to telephone evidence, telephone masks. But there was a telephone expert who we had on the trial, who the police have used ever since our trial, because he was that good, and still use him to this day. Mm-hmm. He was used on the Holly and Jessica murders up in Cambridge. You know, the two young girls?
Yeah, Manchester.
Soham.
Yeah, Soham.
Cambridge.
Yeah.
Because he knew them telephones never left there. He gave the evidence in that trial against Ian Huntley, and mm-hmm. Maxine Carr. That was their... They got convicted on that. That was our telephone expert that the police used today. He says, in the Old Bailey, Nichols was lying and still says it to this day. That man still rings my mother. To this day, and that's a specialist, but they're using,
yeah, and that wasn't even enough to get them off with it.
We've had that one go back to the appeal court, the telephone evidence and the rest of it, but they have ways of saying words to explain different things so that you could say, is this right, and they would do it mm-hmm. a different way.
Is Mick still in?
Yeah, Mick still in.
How hard is it for both men who plead their innocence to then be losing family members and friends while in prison, knowing that you're innocent?
Cool, I should imagine it even harder for them in there.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Did they struggle? Was your dad still around? Did he pass away?
My dad...
When Jack was in?
Yeah, he got cancer. Dad's been dead about 9 years now, but he got cancer. Never knew it. And, he was told he's got cancer, he was dead within 2 weeks. But he went to the jail to see Jack the week before he died, and said to my brother, Jack, just admit it, get home and look after your mother. Just admit it. You get out. And my brother said, I ain't admitting something I never done. Which was terrible emotional roller coaster for them both. Mm-hmm. There's no way that Jack was going to admit for something he didn't do.
When would they have got out if he admitted that?
If they'd admitted it in the beginning, they might have let the 15 years go, I reckon, wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. The first parole date, instead of altering it.
It's scary that people have the power to take away people's lives.
Yeah. So it could happen to any of us, couldn't it?
Yeah. Did you ever worry for yourself to be fighting for your brother's freedom that somebody could have took you away, killed you, or put you to prison yourself?
The rehearsal side of it, no, there was not a problem there, because Jack never done it in my mind, so there was never going to be a rehearsal side. Mm-hmm. The police and authorities side, yes, they monitored me 3 to 6 months of violence. Me, well, I never knew until I tumbled them in the end. And you don't know what they could do. You know, it's a funny thing. But you learn to look at every junction. You learn to look behind, go round and round about twice. That's what I used to do. To fact, I'd still do it a bit today. You know, yeah. Because you just don't know. If they can set them up, they could set you up or me.
Yeah, just keep on your toes at all times. I think there's nothing wrong with a bit of paranoia, but as long as it's not breaking you down.
Yeah.
How's your mum feel that Jack's home?
Oh, she's over the moon. My mum's well into her mid-80s now, so for her to survive COVID, you know, it's not that she's had it, but the chance she could have had it and
been one of the 60,
sad people that we've lost, she could have been one, you know, and to have a boy home for the rest of her life, forever, how long it'll be, she's obviously over the moon.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why she kept fighting, kept hanging on?
Yeah, kept her alive, yeah.
To keep your brother keep fighting as well? It's a sad affairs that if it does get overturned, how two men has lost their lives for over 20 years for murders that didn't commit, but that means there's a murderer on the loose or maybe dead if Steve's right, then... It's just never ending with this, though.
Yeah.
It's always getting brought back up, and it must be hard for so many different people.
Yeah.
It's but you've got to fight your case. You've got to fight for your brother's freedom now that he's out, but you still want it overturned, and that is scary to think that.
The trouble you have and all, you know, I ask myself, you know, with the protests, you know, I done the gantry, the Home Office, I took skeletons in a wall, drove to the Crown Prosecution Service because I said they got all them stunts that I done. You know, but I never got the more publicity after 2009. I put on the front, when I used to go to the appeal court or the high court, I put my banners all the way along that court, all the way along. And I could put what I wanted on them. But in 2009, we had a hearing there. I put on there two police officers' name. And the case to that date had cost 10.5 million. It's over 11.5 million now. But at that particular time, 10.5 million of taxpayers' money. Put two police officers' names up in there. I've never had publicity from that day onwards.
Yeah.
No newspaper touched me. Yeah. No one come near me.
Yeah, you can.
Because I put two names.
Yeah, they don't want to be seen that, because if anything ever happens to them as well, then...
When I was on the gantry, they only showed Jack Wombs and Michael Steele was innocent and never put corrupt police. You never see that on the telly.
Yeah.
Can't do it.
Nah, that.
But you learn them things.
Riots.
But what when I done them, you know, later on, down 20 years down the line, even though I made it a high profile case, you're making it bigger. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to a decision in them courts, that has got to be so precise because it's such a high profile case. So all them judges, all them have got to make the dead accurate. Perfect decision.
Do you think that can go against you sometimes?
Yeah. Did I fuck up doing a protesting?
Nah, because what happens is noise creates awareness also, because if you don't say anything, then they just rest. They just basically die in jail as well. So there's no really any right or wrong way to do it. You just want to keep their name alive and for people to keep looking into it. But if you never done anything, if you weren't here, because I know Johnny Steele, who done the same for Joe Steele, they used to glue themselves to the prison gates and just to keep creating awareness towards their case, and eventually they did get out, but they'd spent over 20 years in prison.
And that's what I used to think about the books and the films and that, you know, it you know, even though when it came out and most of it was shit or made up, but it still kept the case alive, you know. It was doing half my job for me. Mm-hmm. Really, even, you know, somebody's think, oh, what a load of shit in that. But it got publicity.
Yeah, it made the case even bigger.
Yeah, so you've got to go along with it until they turn on you.
Yeah, you've got to take the good with the bad. Mm. John, would you like to finish up on anything?
Yeah, I would. One of the main things is obviously my whole 20 years of doing... The stunts, the publicity, the media and the rest of it, the books, the films, shit, like I say. In the early days when Jack and Mick was in Belmarsh, there was a note left in the visiting hall. And it was by a certain parasite who'd become a parasite. He helped me on the way. He made books. He made films. The parasite I'm referring to is obviously the guy I talk about on my YouTube video, what I had done a few years ago. They invited me to do a programme about a police, corrupt police in Amsterdam. I went on this filming, four-day excursion. We'd done loads of filming all about, you know, the police and what the police would have done. The film company and this parasite decided that they was going to, when they got back, they cut it, edited it. And then you see on this video through a window of me sitting in the bar saying that Jack and Mick done it. No way would I ever come out of that statement, even after 25 fucking years, you know. But that parasite done that to me. He become our friends. He used us to make these books and films, and still making books and films, because it's money to them, you know. Mine wasn't money. Mine was about my brother. And that parasite is writ stuff, you know, and I used to say to him that this is not right. This ain't right, you know. Well, they won't, the people don't know that are going to read it, do they? They won't know in that film whether that happened or not. I can make that up. I said, but it's not right. But I used to think, oh, well, it's keeping it publicised. But when they turned around and altered my voice, turned on me, that parasite is a bad man. He's as bad as what Nichols is. Absolutely bad. And the reason why he done it, I think to myself, why did he do that? Why did he do that? And in the early days, and I used to meet up with him and his girlfriend, and we was at a pub up in Birmingham or Wolverhampton or something, and there was an incident in the pub, and the parasite was having a fight with these guys, and now I'm thinking, I just need to get out of here. So we leave. I'm with the parasite's brother and sister. So we've got to get out of here. So we get in the car and go, and his girlfriend, the parasite's girlfriend at the time, saying, come on, John, we've got to get out of here. So he goes back, gets back there. But then we see him coming across, still fighting with these guys, and they've got knives and all sorts in the car park, thinking, shit, this is all going wrong. He gets back to the hotel. They have a row, the parasite and his girlfriend. He fucks off out. And when he fucks off out, we sit there having a drink. I'm just going to bed. I'll go back to bed, go up to my room. She comes to my room. 2 o'clock in the morning, bang, 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 the fucking thing, the hallway's coming and the doors are coming down, everything. Fuck. What's this noise? Anyway, it's the parasite. He's come back home from his drug-fueled nightclubbing, banging on the door, calling out for his girlfriend to open the door. Anyway, the security have come and took him downstairs, and there's a kick-off in the corridor and all this shit. Anyway, she goes back to her room after, because she ain't in her room, she's in my room. Anyway, she goes back to her room. Next morning, she says to me, John, he takes a lot of tablets for his head and stuff. You've got to get away from this guy. She said, you've got to get away. He's making up shit. She said it to me. I said, I understand the shit he makes up, but it's, you know, it's profiling the case. She said, but he's a bad man. And I think to myself, did he know about that? Is that why he turned on me? Or why did he turn on me? Or did he run out of story and think, I've still got to make money out of it? Because he'd had thousands and thousands out of it. So one of them two questions, is it that or is it not?
Have you ever asked him?
No. I wouldn't need to ring him up. I wouldn't allow myself to ring him up, you know. He come on board, you know, helped me with some stuff early days with the media, but then to turn against you, it's worse than Nichols.
What did your brother and that say when there was footage of you saying that they'd done the murders?
Oh, obviously my brother from jail rung me up and said, John, what the fuck's going on?
Was it getting the papers or anything?
Yeah, it got in a few papers, yeah. You know, and that's why I done a YouTube video about it. And the first YouTube video, they took down because I used their names. I'm talking about a producer from a big film company in London and The Parasite. I used their names to begin with. They took it down. And the evidence of them doing that are in emails. And those emails are on a guy's site called James Waldron, who runs stuff for me. And I'd like to do a special thanks to him. James Waldron lives up Newcastle Way. Those emails to prove what they'd done to me are on that man's site. And that's worth a look. I'm telling you now.
No worries, John. Listen, thanks for coming on today and telling your story. And good luck with Jack. Hopefully they get the fair trial it deserves and everything gets overturned. Anything yeah. I can help with for the future, you've got my number, just give me a call and we can take it from there. But I appreciate it. God bless you, brother.
Thank you.
You can also watch my podcast on my YouTube channel. The link is in the bio if you'd like to subscribe. You can follow me on my social media platforms to see who my next guest is. Follow me on Facebook at JamesEnglish11, Twitter, JamesEnglish0, Instagram, JamesEnglish2. You can also download these podcasts on iTunes or Spotify.